And now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, Wade from San Diego.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Wade, and I'm an alcoholic. This is the neatest meeting. This is really cool. And especially the juxtaposition of the podium to the microphone. I feel like I'm about 6'6", man. This is... Usually I'm standing behind podiums like they're up to here, you know. Wow. Thanks for having me. I'd like to thank Felix for inviting me. It is always, though, kind of an odd sign when the guy that invites you just gets out of town. And he went to L.A. That's his story. He told me he went to L.A., so he got way out of town. So I'm here. And but thanks to him for having me. And it's always an honor. And it is an honor and a privilege to be asked to take part in an AA meeting. And I like speaking, and I tell a good story and all that stuff. And I'm really happy. I'm happy. And I'm happy to be here, especially because I can see that this meeting, I don't know, you know, a lot of people don't think I'm a big book thumper guy, you know, and all that stuff. But I quote the big book a lot. And the only quote I really can really remember is, "We're not a glum lot." Because I don't know about you. No, I know about some of you. I know a lot of people here. This is really cool. But, I didn't come here to have a bad time. I was having a bad time when I went to my first meeting. I came here to have a good time. Please, show me how to have a good time and not drink. You know, that's what I was about. And I pushed my little shopping cart up to my first meeting and parked it at the door. And it was one of those meetings where they went like, "Cool, man, park your cart there. Oh, come on in. Welcome home," and all that. And "We have coffee, and you have donuts," they said. I had donuts and stuff on my shopping cart. I was like the food meister of North Park. And I often say, and it's true, and I had Grey Poupon on my shopping cart, and I had gourmet stuff, and I was ready to go. I always like to look around the room and see if there's anybody that actually ate stuff off my shopping cart before the rooms and in the rooms. Because my first 60 meetings or so, I pushed my shopping cart to the meeting every day, and they were glad to see me, and I was glad to see them, and life was good for a while. I took 60 days at that meeting, and somebody said, like, 60 days? Like, dude, you're still homeless. Like, how's that working? I said, it really sucks. It was good for a year. But not drinking and stuff, it's a nuisance. It's cold, and it's wet. And the restrooms really smell in the park and stuff, and it's weird. But when I was drinking, everything was... I was just Robin Hood and his merry band of hobos and stuff, you know. Felix told me that this meeting was, you know, being taped and all that, which I never mind that. I'll tell a perfect stranger my story. I was trying to tell somebody my story out there, and the meeting was starting, and I had to come in. But they also told me that it's, like, streaming live or whatever. Like, there's a website where people who aren't here can tune in and, like, listen to this, you know. So, you know, like they say at those heavyweight championship fights, you know, "Ladies and gentlemen, across America and all around the world, and to our servicemen and women who are serving everywhere, Wade is here tonight." And I have it on good authority that my wife here called her mother in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and said, "Oh, here's this site. Get up on this. You can hear Wade speak tonight," and whatever. So just in case my mother-in-law, Evie, is listening... Evie, I've got your daughter, and you keep coming back. I love it when the guy who had the cake commitment earlier, I don't know if you heard the whole thing on the tape, but he was, you know, making his bullshit excuse for missing the first week of his commitment. No, he did that. He did that just right. Let me give him some credit there. First week of the commitment, he goes, "Yeah, and I didn't show up." So they had no cake, and they had no this and that, and like somebody yells in the back, "Yeah, we'll kick your ass." And I went, "Wow, these people are into the solution here." But, you know, when you take a commitment like that, a big, heavy-duty, like, AA commitment about cakes, that's serious. No, that is. No, you're the guy with the shit, man. You got it. When you miss that the first week, a couple things happen. One, you find out how really serious they were about you having that commitment. You find out how many real friends you have. And you've also let them know that you're really the boss here, and you may not show up every now and then. So don't be surprised, you know. That's good. Later, when someone said, "Oh, we got the H&I green can going to go around," someone in the back went, "No, we don't." And I turned around and said, "Hey, we'll kick your ass." It's a kick-ass meeting. That's it. And, you know, shit. You said I could go till 11 tonight, right? Yeah, wow. I'm a nickel-dime guy, and I got a little nickel-dime story. And, I guess, what is it, Dave spoke last week? Yeah, my friend Dave. Hey, man, how many people drank after that meeting? One, two, only three? You're getting better, Dave. Only three went out. Well, maybe more did, but these three came back. So you're really coming up in your game. No, you get scared when you speak at a meeting. You know, in the beginning, when I was first speaking a few times, you're going, oh, my God, you know, the responsibility. And, geez, God forbid I should say something and somebody never come back, you know, and all that. And you get all paranoid about it. And really, I'm probably going to have very little to do about whether you drink or not. That's going to be your problem. That's your problem. That's your deal, you know. And I loved it that the 10-minute speaker, great job, by the way. Boy, 10-minute speakers can get scary. Okay, no, that was a great job. When 10-minute speakers start off about their childhood and their parents, you start looking at your watch right away when you're the main speaker going, oh, for Christ's sake. 20 minutes later, the guy's trying to get a drink in kindergarten or something, you know, and you're like, come on. No, that was a great 10-minute talk. And, yeah, that's as good as it gets. But, no, this is super. This is great. I'm here because I don't want to drink. I've heard that before. But, you know, I come here. I don't think I'm going to drink every day or anything like that. I prayed a silly prayer the first couple of meetings I went to. A guy told me, pray. Have you prayed that the obsession be removed? The obsession to drink be removed? And that sounded pretty Christian and pretty like a faith-healing thing to me. And I'd been in a church like that for a number of years. And I thought, well, you know, I really haven't done that. Maybe I should do that. And I went back with my little bedroll to the park that night. And I was really desperate to not drink, you know, and whatever else I was doing for sure. And I looked up at the sky and I just said, hey, you know, we've talked before, I know. And I blew you off all the time, and I don't even know if you exist and all of this stuff. This is really a mess. But listen, if you could please remove the obsession to drink, I could give the rest of this a good shot. I could give it a good shot. But if you can't remove the obsession to drink, I got no shot at all. Because I had stopped about a week earlier and made a big vow to myself, you know, like, okay, that's it. I got to join the squares. I'm done. I'm retired. I feel like an athlete, like a player that played 2 years too many, or a boxer that fights about three fights too many. Like, he's been done before, but he's still fighting. Yeah. No, I was done sitting there in the park all weeping over my shopping cart and crap, you know, in the middle of the day crying and shit. And, you know, what happened to me? I was such a cool kid, you know. And I said, I got to stop. I got to stop, you know. And I stopped, you know. And a friend took me to some intake at a couple of different establishments in San Diego here. And they did a little intake on me. And I didn't know the magic words or how to schmooze these counselors, you know. I just said, yeah, I want to get off the street. I kept kind of saying, I need to get off the street. I'm homeless, you know. Wrong thing to say. You know, these people, they don't light up their world that you want to get off the street. You know, everybody wants to get off the street. They want to know you want to get sober or whatever. And so they had me on these lists to get on these beds. You get a bed, and I would call them every day or so from the phone booth at Morley Field. I was living in the velodrome at Morley Field, that bicycle track. And it was like heaven on earth. I mean, and some of you do have that to look forward to, and I hope it's as good for you as it was for me. It was a good year. It was one of the first years of my life I was self-supporting by my own contribution. Picking up cans and bottles and plastic and stuff and turning them in and, you know, waiting for somebody to come by with something, you know, and pinata parties in the park. God, these Mexicans would party on every weekend through the summer, and you just go around your little loop in the park picking up cans and cans and cans, and they would leave half cans full. And yeah, once in a while, they leave it in a cigarette butt and a half can of beer. You know, if you're any kind of a man, you catch that one, you don't get all into some trip about it like, oh my God, you know. No, you go, well, there's one, whatever, man, and you drink the thing down. But I'm no alcoholic. I'm no alcoholic. I just like free booze, you know. But that last year out there was good, and it just wasn't good after I'd been sober a few days, though. But my life is much like the 10-minute speakers. You know, I had really, you know, good parents in a good little neighborhood in the San Fernando Valley and all that when it was a good place to live. I guess the San Fernando Valley, if you're not aware of it now, and this will be some valuable information for your recovery, the San Fernando Valley, I think, is known now as the world's center for pornography and drugs. And when I was there, it wasn't that way, but we were planting the seeds. We were starting it. We had thoughts that, gee, someday pornography and drugs are going to rule the world. Hey, we should start on this voyage now. The Beatles hadn't arrived yet. The Rolling Stones were just inventing themselves. We're talking way back in the olden days. And it was a nice place to live, and my parents checked my homework, and they paid for my music lessons and tutors if I needed them, and the whole neighborhood watched out for everybody. It was a village raising all these children. It was really neat. It was a good life, which is why I'm standing here going, like, why the hell should I be here? I had no issues like some of you all had. And if you're sitting here wondering, like, why am I here? Maybe it's the same, you know, thing. I had a decent upbringing. There was no abuse or trauma or this or that. I just liked drinking and didn't even know I was falling in love with it. I don't want to seem different, but the truth of the matter is, and I've gone over this thousands of times in the 14 years, 6 months I've been sober, I've gone over this going, no, I didn't fall in love with it. I didn't have that first drink and go, oh, now I can be normal. Now I can talk to girls. Now I got to do this every day, man. How's that? And a lot of people will tell that story, and they're telling the truth. They were 12, 13, 14, had that first little hooch in the other guy's backyard, or stole some after the party, or went around the party drinking the adults' drinks, being cute, and all those stories. And they knew, this is good. My world didn't light up. It was like, okay, that was good. We bragged about it. We went to the drive-in movie. I have to say drive-in movie today because there's young people that you say drive-in and they think you're talking about Starbucks or something. There were big movie screens, and you would all park there and watch a movie. But you could go to the movie and somebody had a jug of wine and we had some hot buttered popcorn. And I'm like 16 and I'm with the guys on the football team and somehow I got invited along or whatever. And that was like a big deal. Me and this other little guy, they stuck us in the trunk and we got in free. We snuck in. We were in the trunk of the car. And we get out. Now there's eight of us in this car, you know. And we're doing hot buttered popcorn and burgundy wine. And I used to say that was my first drunk for a lot of years, speaking or whatever. That was my first drunk. And I finally realized, you know, I wasn't drunk that night, really. I threw up so fast that it couldn't have gotten into my bloodstream, really. We were all laughing and farting and everything, you know. Oh, we're drunk, you know. The guy that drove was drunk. And there was no discussion about, dude, you're too drunk to drive. If somebody said anything, I mean, somebody might have said, give me the wheel, asshole. And he said, shut up. And I'm in the back going, all right, cool. I just can't wait to go to school tomorrow to tell people, like, oh, I was out drinking with Chris and John and Lee, you know, and we drank wine at the drive-in, man. How cool. But the feeling of alcohol did not kick in. One other time in high school, and this was back in the square days, if you were in a white middle-class neighborhood kind of thing, and there wasn't a lot of availability, and everyone was trying to be good little kids and all that. We were the last generation that was trying to be good kids. After that, nobody even tried. But we were trying to parent please and teacher please and people please and you know, get to some college and such. But no, one other time in high school, I got drunk. My best friend and I, and we went through our adolescent and teen years together. Right before graduation, he got a little jug of wine from his brother, and we parked right out in front of the high school, right in front of the name on the high school and everything. And we sat there late at night, you know, and we drank almost all of this little jug of, Red Mountain, Burgundy or some crap again. And we drank this stuff, and we got good and buzzed that night. And I remember I said to him, are you okay to drive? And he said, of course, it's my car, you know. And we were drunk. Yeah, drunk ass. I mean, he paused a few times in intersections and stuff. But it's like 1 a.m, and, you know, no one was out. We got home, and thank God. Thank God no one got killed or we didn't, you know. And a lot of us were here all alive, so we didn't get killed. And maybe there's some people in this room that were involved in the injury or death of other people. And, you know, these are things that we have these steps for, and we have this fellowship and this program for to get through these things. But I'm one of these guys that lived a charmed life. That was just the beginning of hundreds and hundreds, maybe thousands of times, where I was put myself and everybody else that might have been around me at great risk. I was doing risky crap behind drinking and whatever else, man. I mean, it's a wonder. You know, I see stuff on TV today where I go, God, that's probably the first time that person ever did that, and they killed 4 people. I did that all the time and never just got lucky. And I just, and in my sobriety, I thank God for that, I'm still standing here. I'll be 62 years old next month. Got sober when I was 47 and thought there's nothing left for me. You know, Wade's all shot out and old. The young people have taken over the world. And they had. Which is why that first recovery job is like $5 an hour at 7-Eleven. And it's like those speakers that I first heard used to say, oh, in my early sobriety, I got this really bad job, and it was horrible, and my sponsor said, oh, God has you right where you should be, you know. And there I was at 7-Eleven, a bunch of late-night weirdos and asses coming into this place, drunk, tweaking, shoplifting people, and I'm on the graveyard at 7-Eleven in the little green schmuck, just... And I couldn't get hired till I had about 11 months and almost a year in that recovery home. No one was hiring shot out me, but I got the job through a friend's recommendation, and finally, somebody hired me. I didn't care. I was looking a little above 7-Eleven. I'd been a waiter and a hotshot guy all of my life, so I thought if I get a decent haircut and dye my hair, I was going to be a waiter again. Just an interview to be a waiter was freaking me out. But 7-Eleven, there I was on the graveyard, and the highlight of that job was, well, two highlights. One highlight was I stayed there 3.5 years, and I think I missed one day for illness. That was just like way off in the blue, an all-time record for me being on any job. I mean, if I stayed on a job a year, I was already stealing from you whether I needed it or not. I was just screwing up. I looked at my Social Security printout, and I can estimate clearly I've had over 100 employers legit in my life. And all you got to do is have about 4 or 5 a year to do that. That's not even a problem, really. You can do that. But the one highlight came in my recovery, and some of you might have these, you're waiting for the spiritual awakenings and all of these, wait till the miracle happens, and sometimes they sneak right up on you. And one night I was at 7-Eleven, and I'm bored, and I'm scared, and it's about bar closing time, and I know the weirdos are going to come in, and I'm just standing there like, okay. And Leonard, the old man, is asleep, and he's asleep in the back, but, I got somebody there, but it's just kind of like, okay, now the lower-end clientele are going to start coming in, and this sucks. And I'm square now, and I got about 14 months, and have worked the steps at that point, and, and I got a sponsor, and I'm really busy going to meetings before work every night, and I got a little handle on my life, but this is a bad time of night. And some guy comes in who I knew back in the day in the bar scene, and he's getting his Twizzlers and his little hot Fritos and his crap, and he's all barefoot on a rainy night and all... And he comes up, and he's buying the stuff, and I'm looking at him going, how do I approach this? So I want to say hi to Tony, this guy's name was Tony, and I want to say hi and, show myself off in my new way of life, Now, because I'm a straight-up egotist, theater major, is my degrees in speech and drama, and I like some attention and stuff, and I want to get some attention from Tony, who thought he was such hot shit back in the day, and now he's tweaking into my store at night, and I'm the guy with a job, And, that's the motives. That's what my motives were. How can I start a conversation to let Tony know who I am? And look at me, man. Look at me. That's the God's truth. And he's just fumbling with the change, and I'm looking at it clearly going, it's that one, and these two. And come on, dude. And finally, I took the money from him, and I said, hey, Tony, hey, what's happening, man? And he goes, huh? I said, Tony, it's me, Wade. And he looks at me like I've been in a car wreck or something. He looks at me and says, like, what happened to you? And my terminology at that time was, I said, hey, man, I got clean, man. I go to meetings and I'm clean and sober and everything. And he went, ah! And he ran out of the store. If you saw that in some funky movie today, you'd go, that's a bit much. No, I swear to God, he freaked like the zombies had arrived or something, and he ran out of the store. Old man Leonard comes out of the back of the store going like, what happened, man? What was that? I said, it was just an old friend of mine. What, he caused you some trouble? I said, no, I just told him, yeah, this is it. And he looked at me and he fled in the night, At that point, I hadn't thought I had come a long way or anything. I was groveling around at a piss-ass job at 7-Eleven for $5 an hour, paying the rent at my little recovery home still. A salty dog there, though, now. I've been there about a year, about ready to move on and stuff. But I stayed the whole year, I had nothing going on. No one was hiring me. Shit. And it dawned on me right then that, you know what? Maybe I'm doing a little better than I thought. Like, he was just flipped out that I was doing so good. He couldn't even... give me a decent compliment, I just wanted one of those pitiful, wow, good for you, man. No, he freaked out, man. Anyway. And those moments happen sometime, and it's like it stops me or it might stop you in your tracks and go, wow, things aren't as bad as I might want to think they are. you know, I mean, really neat things have been happening in just a short period of time, like 14 months and staying busy and doing all that recovery home stuff and going to a lot of meetings. But I came in wanting to go to meetings. I came in liking the whole deal. And one other time I was at the PB Alano Club, and I'm waiting to go upstairs, and I'm talking to some guy who's kind of all forlorn and glum and whatever. And I'm talking, yeah, I've never been here before. This is a really cool place, man. And, oh, yeah. Well, the meeting's starting. I'm going to go up there now. And I thought he was going to go up with me. And he went like, I'm not going up there. He said, you go up there, though. Go ahead. He says, you're probably going to make it, you know. And it's like some alien coming out of a cloud going, or an angel or somebody going, you're probably going to make it. I mean, I looked at him and went, it wasn't somebody I knew. You know, every now and then some buddy of yours would go, no, dude, we're going to make it. You know, we're going to do it. Here's some stranger going, no, you're probably going to make it. I said, really? Why? He says, you like the meetings. And I was like, duh, yeah. Greatest show on earth for free. I mean, if you don't have a dollar, you get to hear the same bullshit as if you put a dollar in. When we were new at the recovery home and we were getting on the bus and the trolley and the crap and going to La Jolla and going here and there, and we'd see somebody like putting in $5, $10 in the basket or something and not even taking change, and my friend would look at the guy and go, I hope you get your money's worth, dude. What the fuck? You know, if it's good, next week I'll give $2, but this week I give $1, you know, solid transaction. No, I drank from the time I was like 17, 18. And here's the weird thing. Like I said, I didn't know I was an alcoholic from the beginning. I didn't think drinking was a problem. It seemed to me like what everyone was doing. Of course, everyone wasn't doing it. I was 18 in junior college, living at home. So you had to be, you know, kind of careful to not come home too messed up. But my parents actually said to me, look, you're in junior college now and you'll be partying around with some older people and there'll be some drinking and stuff. And like, we're cool with that. But just get a ride to and from the party and all that. If you can do that, like, you know, whatever, cool. And my parents were kind of liberal that way. Or they knew that it was going to happen anyway, so they chose to address it kind of like open. And, okay, well, geez, first day of junior college, I'm looking around to make sure, who's 21? Who's 21? Because in California, it's 21. And I'm 18. So you find people that are 21, and you find people that before the 8 o'clock class in the morning, you know, it's a big glass of vodka and a peanut butter sandwich or something, and you go to classes, and then at noontime, you go down to this place, Corky's Chris and Pitt's barbecue place, and you'd go there, and the guy who's 23 with you, with 10 of you, would go, Ellen, what do we need, like 4 pitchers, and what do you got, 10 glasses, 4 pitchers, 10 glasses, and Ellen would bring them over. If a cop would have got up and said, hey, miss, you didn't card any of these people. She'd have probably turned to the cop and said, my table. Get out of here. Sit down. My table. I'm handling this. These are just kids from the college. Shut up, you know. Because it really wasn't a real issue. I mean, today, every day on the news, they got whole news programs about people getting killed every night by drunk drivers and stuff. Back then, either they weren't reporting it or it wasn't happening as much. It just wasn't a big concern. You know, it didn't seem to me. And then in the afternoon, before our dance rehearsal or our play rehearsal for that night, before that, we would go to someone else's house and come by something. Somehow, I wasn't sitting in bars. I looked about 14 years old when I was 18. I mean, you know, I looked 14 until I was probably 35. You know. Yeah, you're laughing because now you know I did a lot of drugs. Look at me. Jesus Christ. Alcohol doesn't do this to you, baby. No. Anyway, but I was getting that alcohol. And I didn't realize that this is becoming a way of life. It just was a way of life. It was like we drink and we party and we have a good time. We drink, we party, we have a good time. Like the 10-minute speaker said, you know, sadness. There was times when if there was problems or sadness or travail in my life, I might refuse a drink or go, no, not right now. I got to think about this, you know. And over the years, that would be my M.O. There'd be some really weird crap going on. And it would be like, all right, wait a minute. No, we got to think about this. We got to think about this, you know. And it would either be, think about it without drinking. That was the one where you'd go like, okay, let's think about this a minute. Okay, we discussed the plan, get some cuckamamie plan and all that, and get it all figured out. It was all weird crap. It was bullshit. We'd get all done with it and go, all right, fine, we got that figured out. Let's have a drink. Jesus Christ. And then we probably wouldn't even do the plan. Or the planning while I drank was a good one. And that started to be, as my drinking progressed, I still don't think I'm an alcoholic or there's a drinking issue at all. But as I look, some of us, we have to get sober to look back and kind of listen to other people's stories and hear some therapy and some crap and go, wait a minute, I was. That's, yeah, I did do that kind of thing. And my deal would be, there'd be some crap going on, you know, and it'd be, oh, no, we're going to have to kill this guy. Oh, no, this guy, it's too late. No, we just kill this guy. Not kick his ass. One night in the bar, there's about five of us around a table going, no, he must die. No, bullshit. One of us will kill him. And the guy who starts that one is always the guy that knows he ain't going to be the one chosen to do it. He just throws the idea out there. And I'm watching him going, you jerk. By the time he gets around to me, I'm going to have to be the one. You know, you're thinking all this weird shit. But we're going to drink and think of the plan, right? And it'd be really weird. And I'd go, okay, big problem. Yeah, let me, tequila rocks. Thank you. Bang. Or I would say, oh, my thing was tequila straight up in a rocks glass. That way she poured like a double or a triple. She just filled the glass up for you. And bad problems. I mean, really, no, it was a serious problem. If we had our shit together, he'd be dead to this day, but he's not. But I take the freaking glass with a bad problem, a serious, whether it's a marital problem, a children problem, because I got married and kids happened. Yeah, that's happened. But when it was a really deep problem, I'd pour that drink. Take that first sip, not even the first drink, just the first sip and go, all right, this isn't as bad as we're thinking. Wait a minute. Take that second drink and go, you know, actually, there's a simple way out of this. And by the third drink, it's like, hey, you know what? Screw this bullshit. You know what I'm, no, you know, this ain't even, no, this is beneath me. I don't even want to, no. I either don't want to deal with it or we come up with some drunken cockamamie plan. But never, here's the key thing for me. Those of you that knew you were an alcoholic from the first time you drank, you should have known better. You should have come in a lot earlier. You knew. Jeez, I've heard those stories. First time they're ever drunk, they burnt the house down and shit, you know. Some of you know who tells that story. And that's a true story, probably. He really burnt the house down. Other people, first time I drank, I slapped my girlfriend around, and I did with her boyfriend, and I did this, and crashed the car. First drunk. Second drunk wasn't much different. And they went on drinking for 30 years. Come on. No. And I joke about that, but these are deadly serious things. But I'm just trying to tell you, for me, my excuse, if you will, was I didn't think there was anything wrong going on. And I never really got caught for anything. Got pulled over many times, totally drunk, and they didn't have breathalyzers back in the day, or he was a little too busy to be messing with you, or I don't know what. I don't think I really talked that good of a game, but he just, you know, you've been drinking tonight? I said, I had a couple over there, you know, whatever. Hey, man, look, you just go straight home, will you? You know, they're just little things. I just skate around it a lot, you know. Just, you know, never really fall into where I might have fallen into some dastardly stuff. Just lucky. But all along through my drinking, the key was, I didn't see it was a problem. Now, maybe some of you are out there tonight going, it wasn't a problem until I stopped. Then, it's like, wait a minute, we got a problem here. Because I would stop for 2 or 3 days at a time, not by some religious reason or some, oh, I'm not going to drink anymore. I'd just be busy, be tired, be whatever. We're waiting for Friday, whatever. We're working and we just go home after work and watch TV. I just wouldn't have it around the house all the time. I've done all that stuff in chapter 3, not to quit drinking. I just happen to have done all that stuff, which tells you what kind of delusion and denial I was in as an alcoholic. If I'd been busted on that, I would be just what it says. I would have tried to control my drinking by doing all of those things except for one of them, which I'm going to mention. One of them I would never do. It's the stupidest thing I ever saw in the big book. I'm not trying to front you off, but has anyone here ever promised to resign if ever drunk on the job? That just tells you how arrogant and stupid Bill Wilson was. I'm trying to think. Are you doing that to an employer? He's getting your case because your numbers are falling off and you're drunk all the time, Lou. And you're going like, okay, look, Ned. If I'm ever drunk again, I agree to resign. He's looking at you across the desk going, get the heck out of here now. You're fired. Oh, thanks for the agreement. That's a good one. Lou's going to be okay. He agreed to resign if he's ever drunk on the job again. Print up his last check now because he's gone, man. Or better than that, what do you say to a, you say that to a wife and 3 kids? Okay, look, everybody. I agree to resign if I'm ever drunk on the job again. Your wife's looking at you like you're out of your goddamn mind. What? I don't care if you're throwing up and having convulsions. Don't you quit that job. But all of those other things in chapter 3, and I used to hate hearing that read at meetings. When I was new, I hated reading that. I hated hearing it, and I certainly didn't want to read it. Because I hated that one thing about the resigning if ever drunk on the job. All the rest of them were full of crap, too, if that one was. And actually, over the 14-plus years of my recovery, I keep listening to it more and more, going, no, I did do that. But not to control my drinking, I'm thinking. I just did those things just to keep everybody off of my case, or to hide my little party, because my life was a party. That old cartoon back in the day, those black and white cartoons, Aesop's Fables, yeah? You remember those suckers on TV? You knew it was a moral bullshit from the beginning. This is the story of the ants and the grasshopper. And the ants were all working in this cartoon for a rainy day, storing stuff down in the hole. And the grasshopper had this fiddle. And he's dancing around laughing at the ants like they're chumps. And he's going, oh, the world owes me a living. Wah, 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 wah. And of course, I'm like 6 years old, so help me God, 6 or 7. And I'm watching this going, I know where we're going. I know where we're going. The winter comes in the cartoon, and the ants are all down in their little hole with all their little goodies all stashed up, having a little party underneath the ground. And the grasshopper's all dead up in the snow, all faded, his fiddle all, you know. And the ants go up and grab him and drag him on down, and not like in real life, they'd have just eaten his ass. No, they bring him down. They show the ants bringing him down and, like, nursing him back to health with a little candle on the table and all this bullshit, you know. And at the end, like, they have to tell me, I'm a bright kid, they have to go, and so, you know, the moral is, you know, to frit and play and goof around a lot is a bummer, because what you should be doing is slaving away and doing this stuff for a rainy day so you have a good life and all that. And I'm like, I knew what the moral was. My parents were full of all the best gear. I was telling someone earlier, my parents gave me all the good information. And they were liberal, but they were liberally into the new literature and the new psychology and the stuff. And they gave me all the information I would have needed to get through the 60s and the 70s and been cool. And I saw that Aesop's Fable and I thought, yeah, yeah. But you know what? The grasshopper was the coolest guy in the cartoon, man. At 6 or 7 years old, I thought, no, the grasshopper's cool. And in my life, I saw the grasshopper on Life magazines a lot. Before there was People magazines. Then I saw them grasshoppers on People magazines. And then as I become, adept at the drama in high school and all that, and then in college I get a little agent, I'm just waiting to be on the cover of that magazine where they say, this guy gets paid more, gets laid more, gets Oscars more. He is just the bitchinest thing since sliced bread. Screw the ants. I just want to be... No. I just wanted to be loved and worshipped by everybody and rich and famous and all full of that. You know, that's not a bad goal, you know. But coupled with that, a disgustingly non-existent work ethic, totally lazy, totally immature, and then you're an alcoholic and don't know it. And you're just drinking and fritting your life away, and that's what I did for 30 years. And I went through a couple of marriages, three children in the 11-year marriage, and... I hated it, you know, and I later, when I got sober, started to really, for the first time, appreciate the guilt I had about not even being guilty about leaving the kids. Because I left this decent woman with three kids one day out of the blue, just said, no, figure it out, I'm out of here, you know. And it took me years, another 10 or 12 years to get into recovery. I came to San Diego and I fell in love. I'll tell you what a high bottom guy I was, man, or a high roller. I fell in love with the intersection of 30th and University. I came up out of the canyon behind TGI Friday with my bag in hand, having fled my family in Palm Springs, you know. And I hiked up through North Park and somehow got to 30th and University. And I'm standing there going like, whoa. 99-cent stores, bars, sleazy little shops, and people walking around in the broad of daylight that look sick. That look ready for a good-looking hustler like me, man. I'm ready for this. And I love that sleazy little corner, man. And it's getting a little better down there, but I can still go by there and go, wow, this was the corner where I thought, I've arrived. I got out of that marriage. I got out of that bullshit life. Trying all my life to just look normal or be normal. Please my parents. Just look like a normal guy. When am I going to grow up and just have a job and do the right thing and all that crap? No way. It started, and I knew that in junior college. That's when it started. After a year of junior college, the guy called me in one time, this counselor. And here's another break-off moment where you don't realize what you are. Counselor calls me in and says, wow, Wade, you've fallen just a hair below a C average here now. And this professor is the one. This is the one. You should go talk to him. I know. You do a little paper for him or something and make it up, and you'll be above a C average, and you won't lose your student deferment. And like some people are like, what's a student deferment? Well, it meant if you were a student in good standing, like above a C average, you know, full time and whatever, you know, you wouldn't be drafted. Now, you got to explain that to some young people. Though it's coming out in the news a little more lately. A draft is like you would register for the draft at 18 years of age, males would, and then they would just pick, if they needed people to be in the army and shit, they would just pick your name, and you'd get a letter that said, hey, welcome aboard, dude. And it wasn't like you had 30 days to reply or, we'll give you the boot camp free and you can cancel at any time. No! They were going to suck you into the armed forces against your will. It wasn't even a question. You're drafted. So a student deferment for many were very important. I wasn't thinking about it. I was just living at home, driving 5 miles to junior college, partying my little ass off, star of all the plays, just having a ball. And then the guy says that. And I went, okay. Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to go in the military. It was 1966. They got old Vietnam. It was just heating up a little bit, you know. So help me God. We went down the block to Corky's, Chris and Pitts, and the guy ordered the beer and the glasses, and I had an order of French fries. And here's the heavy drinker I am. It don't take me much. I made about 2 swigs of beer and a couple of fries, and I'm going, I don't want to even talk to that professor. I don't want to have an adult look at me and judge me and tell me what to do. That's embarrassing. I don't want to do that. I'm such a wimp. I'm not like that today. I don't want to have to deal with shit face to face. I don't want to. This is uncomfortable. I'd rather be fiddling something. My wife knows when I'm really going through something, I'll watch CNN for 48 hours straight and go, I'm processing something, leave me alone. It's an honest program, dear. So I'm having this 2 swigs of beer and these French fries, and I said, no, I got a plan. I'm going to fool these jerks. I'm just going to join the Marine Corps. Because you know what? I look about 14 years old here, and I'm, you know, about 115 pounds when I joined the Marine Corps. So help me God. No, I was into dance rehearsals and stuff, and I was just 115 pounds, about 5'5" and a half, and just Peter Pan wished he was as cute as me, dude. No, I was cute. And I said, you know, it's time for me to grow up and do some man shit. It's time for me to, you know, go burn and pillage and shoot and get shot at. And no, we're laughing now because we made it. Some other people didn't. But I seriously had that moment where, you know, I'm going to go find out what that shit's all about. I'm going to face down death and come back. And if I do come back, I'll have a lot of good stories to tell. The women will like that. I might have a little crease across my butt or something. That's where I got shot, honey. Check it out, babe. You know, I had all that macho TV bullshit, that brainwashing to make it's time for me to go do this thing. I didn't care about the communists or the people of Vietnam or the politics of it or nothing. It was like, hey, I'm going to get out of town for about 3 years. But again, not being the alcoholic, it's not like some of you who said, I got to get out of town because my drinking's out of hand. It's a little town. I got to go to a bigger city to do my party. No, I want to get out of town because I really thought I needed to grow up. So I joined the Marine Corps. And then they said, if you want to be in the infantry, just put 0300 on every piece of paper we give you. Like as though I better do that. And I put 0300 on every piece of paper. Toward the end of boot camp, they said, well, you're all going to be in the infantry. You know that, don't you, already? You're all going to go to Vietnam. And I'm like, 40% of you are going to be dead this time next year. That's the way it is. And they laid all this fear and shit on you, and it wasn't bullshit. They were told to tell the truth. And I was in the infantry in a Marine Corps line company, and then I can reflect on when the drinking became utterly serious. Because over there, it's like, you are scared all the time. I don't give a shit what anybody tells you. You know, it's just, you're getting shot at all the time and shooting at people, and people you don't even know. I mean, that's, you know, it'd be one thing if you knew them. I owe that dude money. No, these people, hey, you don't even know me. What are you doing to me? And we, that country did not order our teenage bullshit. We ran through that country. And here, you know, I thought these guys I was meeting when I first got there was like about 35 years old. They're coming up to the truck to pick the new guys. Here's these three raggedy-ass looking guys about 30, 35 years old. I come to find out that afternoon they're like 18 and 19 years old. I said, what happened to him? He says, he's been here about 8 months. Shit. But I did the Vietnam thing, and I couldn't get wounded, and I lived a charmed life there. But while I was there, I found every way to get loaded there was, that the military could offer, and doctors, you could lie to doctors, you could do any damn thing you wanted, and we just partied. Every time we weren't actually fighting, we were partying, and every now and then you were partying, and then they'd go, oh, no, it's not like you're on a break here. Get out there, something happened. And you'd be loaded, running around, going, oh, shit, you know. And funny stuff now, but not good when you're really doing it, man. And I used to say when I was newly in recovery, the VA was dealing with me, and they said, oh, you drank and all that over Vietnam. And I said, no, not a bit. No, no, no. I've closed on that. There's a bunch of bullshit. And no, I moved on. No, I think I'm really just an alcoholic / addict at the time and all that. You know, that's just me. And about 4 or 5 months into being sober, I had a real bad dream, real bad, the worst ever. And I went to that case manager, and I had that because I was a veteran. I went to the case manager and said, no, I had bad dream. I had guilty-ass, bad-ass, bum dream, really, couldn't even get back to sleep, blah, blah, blah. And she directed me to the right place, and I took care of those other issues. And it wasn't a big deal, but I was able to have that opportunity to address them. And I encourage everyone to address whatever your, we call them outside issues. Four fingers is an outside issue, okay? I got you. Now, but I want to make this one comment. A lot of times there's a bunch of upheaval and a bunch of opinions from people that aren't doctors, aren't psychologists, haven't got a clue about anybody else's business but their own, and probably don't know your own very well, about medical things and outside issues, drugs and psych meds and all that horse crap. Well, you know what? That's just it. It's an outside issue unless you're a doctor and unless you're their doctor. It's none of your goddamn business, you know? And, yeah, no. You're going to wake up someday with some problem. The doctor's going to tell you to go here, try this Prozac, and we'll see if it even works. And you're going to be going, oh, God, thanks. I hope it does too. And you were the one who used to dog the guy till he jumped off the bridge because, you know, you wouldn't sponsor him because he used psych meds or some bullshit. Don't even go there with me on that one, man. I talked to doctors in this fellowship, and I saw a guy giving some advice to a sponsee. And I said, oh, are you a doctor? And he said, no, but I had the same experience he had, and I'm just telling him what I did, you know. And I've talked to doctors who I've said, would you give anybody advice about these psych meds and stuff? And the guy said, no, I wouldn't do it anyway. And I said, even if they were your patient, he says, I wouldn't have a patient in here. I'm not going that way. I sponsor somebody. I don't do doctor with them. I advise them to go to a doctor. And we should do what we need to do, and that's the way that is. I got about 1 minute left, so I'm going to tell you what happened here. I came in, like I said, hungry to be sober. I was 47 years old and a piece of shit with my shopping cart, you know. And when you don't drink or use for about 60, 70, 80 days, you realize you really are a piece of shit. This really is useless. This is no good. And I got an opportunity to go into the VA 28-day program. A lot of information, a lot of good camaraderie. I thought it was the Ritz-Carlton AA summer camp or some shit, you know. And I liked it. I liked recovery from the beginning. And I went to a recovery home and stayed there a year. I worked the steps. I went to a lot of meetings. I took part. I liked to do this stuff because I had nothing better to do. If you got something better to do, then go do it. Why? You know. Jesus. No, you know. That's why so many people go out. They're really here and they can't do or don't want to do what we're doing. So you're taking up space and you're breaking our heart and you're dying and you're, you know. I want you all to just be ready. And then whatever's going to happen is going to happen for you. And good things will happen. Other things will happen that aren't so good. But you know what? If you didn't stay sober, nothing would be happening except you'd be a piece of shit like you were when you got in here. If anybody came in here like that old business said, oh, what a beautiful day, the sun is shining, I just won the lotto, I met the woman of my dreams, or man of my dreams, or whatever your preference is and all that, I would go to an AA meeting. Of course you wouldn't do that. You come here because there's no other way out of your bullshit. And I've come to find out my experience, Strength and Hope, is just this. The 12 steps, honoring the 12 traditions, this book, and any other thing God might enlighten you about, because it says our book is meant to be suggestive only, God will disclose to you more and more, and more will be revealed. You're going to find in here that there's a way out of your bullshit. Half this room at least, two-thirds, a lot of this room, most of it. You found a way out of your bullshit. You know the way out. And you're here to help other people get that same thing. That's all my purpose is in life. Did I happen to have a job? Good, that pays the bills. AA certainly wouldn't. But you know what? You know what, though? Because of Alcoholics Anonymous and me staying sober, I'm able to pay most of my bills. That's why I married her. She can pay some of them, too. Thank you for letting me share with you tonight. Thank you.